Being an immigrant means sometimes we don't have a choice. We cannot wait for something to happen. We have to make it happen. I am so excited to welcome Ella Altshuler, also known as Ella Leah, among the creative and music circles of London, Moscow, Baku, and Los Angeles to the show. Ella is a singer, songwriter, jazz musician, author, and poet originally from Azerbaijan, who is now living in London. Ella grew up in communist Azerbaijan, where she first got exposed to jazz and American music through a record she heard from singer Liza Minnelli. She had never really heard anything quite like it, and she got hooked. Being a classical pianist and singer, Ella found it easy to switch to jazz. She just joined a band and became quite possibly the first female jazz singer in Baku. Her band sometimes played and practiced in clandestine, because that kind of music was not openly supported under the communist regime. But Ella didn't just stop there. She went on to challenge the status quo yet again by moving to Moscow to join a Jewish theater group, but continued to work on her singing and songwriting career. Finally, Ella was able to leave all of that behind with the help of some friends and migrate to the States in the 90s and continued to build her music career. Ella attributes a lot of her successes and tenacity to being an immigrant and a creative. She says, "Being an immigrant means sometimes we don't have a choice. We often leave everything that we know and love behind to start afresh, to start a new life, and that makes us bold. We know we don't have a choice. We cannot just sit around waiting for something to happen. We have to make it happen." Ella certainly followed that advice. She had a friend drop her off to the music department in Old Dominion University in Norfolk, Virginia, a place she first moved to when she came to the States, and demanded a job teaching music simply because of her credentials and experiences in Moscow. Ella continued to channel her creativity and her passion for music, and one thing led to another, and soon she was recording music not only in English, but also in Russian, something she hadn't even done in Russia growing up. Most recently, Ella has become an author, writing a novel that is now in talks of becoming a film in Azerbaijan. This led Ella to be invited by the Ministry of Culture back to Baku, a place she only recently visited after 30 years of being away. Ella says, "It was exactly how I remembered it to be. I could smell the oil, the sun, and the ocean as soon as I walked out of the plane." Ella has had such a fascinating life, and I know you will enjoy learning more about her on this episode of Culturally Ours.
Welcome to Culturally Ours, a show where we explore global cultural diversity in an intimate way through conversations and narratives around lifestyle, culture, food, art, and travel. Host Karthika Gupta talks to people from all over the world who have intimately experienced different cultures as a way to understand each other's worlds from the inside out, focusing on what we have in common.
Welcome, Ella. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Of course, it's a pleasure.
You have such a fascinating story, and I know we're going to have a great time getting to know you. But perhaps to just, you know, set the stage, can you give us a little bit of background of where you're from, your home country, where you grew up, your family, and just all that good stuff?
Yes, very shortly. I was born Ella Naroditskaya in Baku, the capital of Azerbaijan. I lived there until my late teens. Then I moved to Moscow, joined the theater, joined jazz orchestra, studied at the music conservatory, and then I immigrated to the United States. First it was Virginia, then it was Chicago, then California, and now here I am in London. So that's very short.
Excellent. You've kind of moved around quite a bit.
Yes, it's almost, you know, it's almost I was listing all these immigrations and migrations, and I was getting scared myself.
So what are some of your core sort of memories growing up in Azerbaijan?
Sunshine, the very particular air, sort of a mixture of oil, because it's an oil city, one of the biggest producers of oil in the world. So it's that incredible mixture of sun and oil in the air. And, you know, I just visited Baku 30 years, first time in 30 years. And I was wondering when the plane landed, and I was saying to myself, because in my book that I wrote, the conclusion of the book, my character, my heroine, returns back to Baku after many years. And the first thing she reacts to is that amazing mixture in the air. So I stepped out of the airplane and I inhaled, and it was exactly like many, many, many years ago. The memory was absolutely right.
Wow. Isn't it amazing that after so many years still, you had that same reaction and that same feeling? I mean, it never really goes away. Where where you're from is always a part of who you are.
Exactly, you know, and it comes in such unexpected ways. For example, I was there just a week ago, sitting at a jazz festival with my friends, new and old, and then a gentleman walks in and just plumps next to me in the chair and leans to me and says, "You know what? You actually have not changed a bit." And I look at him and I almost speechless, because I realize that the character in my novel was inspired by this artist that I met, it's almost scary to say, over 40 years ago, and took a walk with him through the city. And that was it. And then many, many, many years ago, he comes back in a novel. An artist with that wonderful sense of freedom that for me, 17 years old girl growing up in the Soviet Union, was almost unthinkable. So definitely there is something in us, sometimes it's conscious, sometimes it's so deep, and it comes to the surface in the most unexpected ways.
Wow, that's incredible. I'm like speechless. I don't know what to say. It's such a beautiful way of kind of just expressing and also just feeling. So what were some of the challenges you faced when you were growing up?
You know, the challenges, I always believe that challenges come with the comparison. Our challenges were to study very well, to achieve, to make our parents happy, to make our motherland happy, to be a very good daughter of the Communist Party. So until the last, I think it was pretty generic, it was pretty universal. But that last moment, yes, I wanted to grow up and be an astronaut and fly to Mars and put the red banner on top of Mars, you know? So the challenge was to achieve, to overachieve. And, but of course, different challenges came when the realization of the Iron Curtain came. Because until, I would say, even in my book, I write that by the age of 15, communism has become my religion. So the challenges were to protect our motherland from capitalism, from imperialism, from America, from everything. And then almost overnight, everything changes. You expand your world by just accidental meeting. You hear Liza Minnelli's Maybe This Time. You don't understand the words, but you hear the music and it enters you. And it produces some kind of a dormant memory, you know, of something different, something beautiful, something so huge, much bigger than you or your belief in communism, you know. So the challenges change. Suddenly you feel straight jacketed in that beautiful childhood that you thought that that was the best. And you want to get out, you want a freedom, you want to experience something else. So the challenge changes. So that's how I can say that it's just stepping from very, very comfortable, very good Soviet childhood into rebellious teenage period.
So Liza Minnelli does tend to have that sort of an effect on on people, on music.
Yeah, who would have ever thought?
But I mean, I can only imagine it must have been quite a stark difference from, you know, that like you said, pleasing your motherland, doing everything for your country, to then trying to figure out how to leave it all behind or escape it because of this, you know, freedom that you're sort of getting a little insight into. So how did you kind of transition from that sort of a restrictive, if I could call it that, environment to, you know, freedom, freedom of expression, freedom of expressing art, creativity? How did that come about?
You know, it all started with the Green Door. And I've talked about that so many times. It almost, and then, of course, I wrote about it in my kind of a semi-autobiographical novel. But there was a store that opened across the street from my school. And everyone warned us not to come close, not to go around, because the owner was either a sorcerer or perhaps American spy. So, of course, we just walked kind of around, would cross the street even, not to go there, but some kind of a strange force kept pulling me in until I couldn't resist. And I walked into the tiny little shop, and I saw a very strange character sitting cross-legged on the carpet there in a turban and leather pants, and it was a very unusual combination at that time in Baku. So he lured me by putting the record of Liza Minnelli, and then I saw the poster of her from Cabaret, and I was just absolutely stunned. I was hooked. I wanted to sing like this. There was so much nostalgia, and there was so much, some kind of a, in my imagination, played for me, there's some beautiful world unknown, something far away, you know, maybe from some stories that my grandmother told me, and I just did not understand it in right concept, but there was obviously nostalgia for something unknown and bigger than me. And at the time, I was a classical student of classical piano, and I participated in competitions and everything. But that moment, I think that was the transition. I wanted to become a singer. I wanted to sing in that beautiful, low, chesty, velvety, raspy, I can use a lot of adjectives here, voice. And I started coming to that little shop, and this sorcerer provided me with more and more records. It was Sarah Vaughan and Billie Holiday and Ella Fitzgerald. And I started imitating all the singers, and I just started, you know, feeling different way of expressing yourself, not just from Chopin or Rachmaninoff or Tchaikovsky, but also in that much freer form of expression. And then there was an incredible jazz musician in Baku who actually mixed the traditional Azerbaijani vocal form called mugam with Western jazz. And he died very young. He died before he even turned 40. And he was, of course, he was invited to Montreal and to the greatest jazz festivals and awarded for his music, but he was never allowed to leave the country. So he died in poverty in Baku without even any having chance to play his music anywhere else. So in his memory, a group of musicians like myself, enthusiasts, we created a studio and we started playing together. I think I was probably considering that Azerbaijan, even though Soviet, but still was a Muslim country, republic, it was quite daring to play piano, sing jazz in a small cafe in Baku. I guess I was one of the first, if not the first girl to do so.
That's incredible. Oh my God, I'm like getting goosebumps just listening to you. That's such an incredible experience, but so awfully brave of you too. I mean, the fact that, you know, it's communist country, it's a Muslim country, you're doing jazz, which, you know, is not typical. Were you scared?
I think that when we're young, we're not scared. I think that we experiment, we dare, we enjoy this. I don't think we think about consequences much, do we? You know, I'll give you a very funny example. I started performing. They built in Azerbaijan, they built the most amazing sort of a club, concert hall. It was done for the visit of the first secretary of the Soviet Union, Brezhnev, Leonid Brezhnev. So they built this gorgeous, beautiful pavilion that seemed like a float over the city almost, really gorgeous. And because someone learned that Leonid Brezhnev actually liked jazz, in the Ministry of Culture, they quickly started looking for anyone who could actually put together a jazz program for him. And they found some old gentleman that played jazz in the 50s, and then jazz was prohibited, and he played weddings and funerals for 20 years. So he put together a group of terrific jazz men from the 50s, and I sang with them. So Brezhnev never attended the show because he had some accident, whatever. So they whisked him back to Moscow. But they opened this beautiful hall that's called Gulistan, the Palace of Roses. And we performed there for a few months. And I will never forget that once my father's colleague came up to him and said, "You know, I saw your daughter on stage performing." And my dad said, "Oh, you probably confused her with someone else," which speaks of, it was not particularly, my dad wasn't particularly proud to hear that I was performing in a club.
Right. I was just going to ask, I mean, with all this, like all these, you know, changes and all these kind of ways of expressing yourself with music and jazz, how did your sort of, you know, how did your family react? How did your parents react to all this?
You know, my parents were very cool, I have to say, but not that cool. So they wanted me to become an engineer like my dad. They wanted me to continue with my music education. The idea of their daughter performing on stage was not exactly what they had in mind for me. But at the same time, they were really very, very intelligent, very understanding people. They, me and my sister, they were incredibly supportive in whatever they felt our passion lay. So, for example, I was invited to study in Moscow at the music college because I won some music Olympics, whatever, through republics, Azerbaijan, Armenia, and Georgia. So, and I was only 13. So my dad took me to Moscow to study there. Of course, I got very scared, and it was my choice to return back to Baku. But I can only say that now, of course, going back so many years, I understand my parents very well. And I think that right. They were pretty brave dealing with two girls that were very, how they called us, my parents used to say that, what can we do? We've got two extraordinary daughters.
I think that's fabulous. That's absolutely fabulous. So then why did you decide to leave all that and sort of migrate? Was it by choice or was it circumstance?
First of all, I left Baku for Moscow. I joined Jewish music theater in Moscow. It was sort of a clandestine theater, my clandestine, because it was Soviet Union was quite anti-Semitic country, not Azerbaijan. This is something that growing up in Azerbaijan, I never faced this problem. But moving to Moscow, it was quite horrendous. And for Jewish theater to exist in the middle of the capital was not something that the government wanted. So the story of how the theater was created was quite amazing, because the director of the theater, who was a public artist of the Soviet Union, amazing choreographer and musician and composer, he basically invited all the diplomats, all the ambassadors at the time who lived in Moscow, at this beautiful Taganka Square. And he locked the whole cast. It was before me, before I joined the theater. He locked the whole cast in the theater. And because the Soviet government sent bulldozers to just destroy the building. And he threatened the government to blow up the building with the cast inside, in front of all the carriers from all over the world. So what does it say? That was really life in the Soviet Union. The only way to create the Jewish theater was to show in front of the whole world that Jews were persecuted, that Jews could not have their own theater since 1946, when the head of the Jewish theater was actually viciously killed. So I joined the theater because it was sort of an incredible oasis for youth like me, who wanted to sing jazz, to dance modern dance, you know, who dreamed about a world outside of the Iron Curtain.
I mean, sounds like you've had such a fascinating life, and you at this time you're probably what, in your teens, right?
I moved to Moscow. Actually, because I kept going back and forth, I moved there when I was almost 22 years old.
Okay.
That's when I started working at the Jewish Music Theater. Before then already, I tried to leave the Soviet Union and I was refused. So I joined the group called sort of Refuseniks. People who were not allowed to leave the Soviet Union. And working with the Jewish Music Theater, then I started touring with two major jazz orchestras. I was never allowed to tour abroad.
Wow. it's everything that you say just gives us so much of insight into how life must have been like for you.
Yeah, slice of history. Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, as I'm listening to you, I feel like in spite of it all, sounds like you and, you know, the rest of the group really found a way to pursue what you love. I mean, it's clear that music and, you know, jazz and it's all such a strong part of you and strong part of like you as a creative, as an artist, that somehow you found a way to pursue your passion. And that's, you know, that's commendable. I mean, we, you know, like, I guess my generation is, you know, some of the problems that we face are nothing compared to what you've sort of experienced, and you've still kind of persevered, and you know, you're a celebrated artist, you've written books, you've kind of had such an incredible life. So really hats off to you. Let's kind of get back to a little bit of the, you know, immigration and migration story. So after Moscow, you've kind of now gone to, you've come to the States?
Yes, I came to America with the help from, I entertained, I sang jazz for the American industrialist Armand Hammer, and he had his retinue with him. Nicky Cantor, who became Bill Clinton's manager of his campaign, George Kiefer, who wrote the Constitution of Los Angeles, and amazing gentleman who actually was from Illinois, Pete Gavankar, who became dearest friend, as well as his daughter, Janina Gavankar, who is a beautiful, amazing actress in Hollywood now.
Okay.
So these three people, they helped me to get out of the Soviet Union. I'm thankful to this day to these three people who they reached out to Senate and everything. They were able to get me out of the Soviet Union. So I arrived in Virginia in 1990.
Wow. So how was that experience like? Because I'm sure, you know, coming into an environment like the States, which is so different from what you're used to, how did you transition into life here? Was it easy? Was it difficult? How did you kind of overcome any sort of challenges and make a life for yourself here?
It was very strange at first, because here I am in Moscow. After all said and done, it's a very huge, very cultural, very sophisticated, very difficult major city. And a few hours later, I'm in Norfolk, Virginia. In small two-story buildings with cut grass, with a lot of people sitting on the steps who were later, I learned, on welfare, with no streets, with no pedestrians, paths, with cars passing by. So it was very scary. I remember first 2-3 days, I had no idea even how to get from point A to point B. Because after all said and done, you see, and that's what complicated about all this, that you reject life because you want, obviously, freedom. You want freedom of expression. You want to see the world. On the other hand, you realize that that here you are now, you're in America, and that element of humanity that kept us very close in Moscow, in the Soviet Union, is sort of not as strong as what we used to.
Right.
So I think that was the hardest thing for me at the beginning, just to understand, how can I walk the streets? I always loved walking in Moscow. I would go and I would walk from street to street for kilometers. Here, I couldn't even get to a store. Of course, a group that I found myself surrounded with people who were on welfare, who weren't working, because that's all I could afford at the beginning, was devastating. And the worst part of it, of course, were cockroaches everywhere. So with all this said and done, within the first 3 weeks, I formed 9-piece jazz orchestra that consisted of the amazing jazz Navy musicians, because Norfolk is sort of a Navy capital of the United States. There are 5 Navy bases. And so together with their wonderful gentleman, jazz saxophone player, Dan Smith, who was by then, he was like 43 years old and he was retired after Korean War or whatever. So we put together an amazing 9-piece group. And after the first month, I started teaching at Old Dominion University. So in that respect, it was very quick. I just went to the university. No, first I was sent to work at some paper board and company. They gave me this job, sitting with 50 women in fluorescent, you know, whatever building, working on computers. I came to this office, whatever, to this room. I worked there exactly for an hour and a half. then I called that gentleman, Dan, because I didn't have a car, and in Norfolk, I couldn't get anywhere without a car. So I asked him to pick me up and take me to the nearest university. So he brought me to this Old Dominion University. I asked where the music department is. I went to the corridor of the music department, asked the first person I saw where was the head of the department. He said he was the one. And I said to him that I must teach there with my very, very limited English. I explained that I graduated from Moscow Conservatory. I tried with my hands, with whatever. I was explaining that I am great and I just really need this job. So I started teaching the next week.
I applaud your tenacity. Oh my God. That's incredible.
I have to tell you that that's what immigration does. Would I ever do something like this now? No. I would be sitting for years, for decades, and obsessing about how to do it and how to write the letter and how. No, that's exactly the element of immigration. That's why we immigrants, we succeed because we don't have a choice.
Absolutely. I mean, it's like, you know, you leave everything that you know, that is familiar, that you've grown up with, and suddenly you're thrown into a situation or a place, or you have no idea, but somehow you land on your feet and you take those, you know, steps, in your case, going up to the music department and saying, I need a job. There's no, you know, do you have a job for me? Or, you know, I would like to apply. It's like, I need a job. This is what I do. And I do it really well. And I need this. So, I mean, I say it again, I applaud your tenacity. And, you know, you're so spot on in that. As immigrants, that's something we have going for us. We don't have a choice. I mean, you know, this is what we've dreamt of. And in some cases, we've escaped. In some cases, we've made a conscious decision to leave everything. So we don't really have a choice.
And, you know, I noticed something very interesting. Of course, this whole immigration process goes through so many stages. There is a stage, like we just talked about, when you come and you suddenly feel so patriotic about the past, that you actually left, you escaped, and suddenly here you are facing your so-called dream, and the only pride you have to hold on to is actually your patriotism for the country you escaped.
Very true.
So I think that's a very kind of initial stage in this process of immigration. And for me, it was maybe a little bit different because I started sort of this Americanization process while still in the Soviet Union by singing jazz, by spending a lot of time with foreigners, with Americans. But nevertheless, here I was. At the beginning, we immigrants, the major thing that's taken from us is our pride. And how do we deal with this? How first we're holding on to something from the past, from our previous successes, for our previous comfort. Then we gradually begin to build up something that we can call our own. And I think it's a very exciting process. In my case, professionally speaking, it happened very fast, almost too fast. I have to admit that there were moments, I remember when we were doing one of the big concerts, it was a huge festival in Richmond, Virginia. And we did a two-hour program with my band. And I remember turning to Dan and saying, Dan, I am so scared. Everything just happened too fast.
Wow. So I was just going to ask you, so as an artist, as a musician, that's something you've kind of done since you were a teenager, right? And now you are an author.
Yes.
So kind of walk us through how that came about. How did music and art sort of transition into a book? And I think earlier you mentioned you did some sort of an autobiography as well. So what was going through your head when you decided to kind of become an author?
You know, has to do with some losses that I had in my life. I also think that talking about how it actually happened, I just released my recording called Russian Romance, something that I never anticipated doing, and that's again returns us back to this immigration element. When I lived in the Soviet Union, I refused to sing in Russian. Russian represented for us the language of oppression. So I came to America, I sang in English, I sang in Yiddish, and then I was at the studio with my musicians preparing, warming up, and my producer comes up to me and says, "What did you just sing? This is amazing." And I was like, "What was I singing?" "Oh, just Russian Romance." He said, "Why are you recording jazz or this or that? This is what you should sing. This is the most beautiful thing that ever came out of your mouth." So 14 years into immigration, I record Russian Romance, album of songs that I wrote music to, my favorite poetry from my childhood or my youth. Some of wrote my own poetry. And that was the most successful album that I really, and I think that in terms of, I really reached, I think, the top of my musicianship, especially working with this amazing Chicago artist, Farid Haq. I always say that he brought the level of my musicianship above my own. But this is what happened first, and I dedicated that record to my parents, because this is something that they could obviously relate to. Then I do interview with a music critic for Los Angeles Times, and he asks me all the questions for the feature story there. And then he says, "You know, you've got such an amazing life, and the way you speak, you've got to write. Have you ever written anything?" And I said, "You know, I wrote some diary, and I remember I was approached by this quite famous Chicago dramaturgist, Vicky Quaid, who wrote Late Night Catechism. She wanted to do a show with me, play based on my life. But seriously, never." He said, "We've got to start writing with you." And the gentleman, besides that he was a jazz legend, journalism legend, he also has written a lot for television, for film. So I started writing with him. But then gradually, I just went back to Baku in my mind. That writing came purely from the gut.
No, I mean, what you said, in my mind, it just sort of solidifies this sort of hypothesis that I have that, you know, at the end of the day, where we are from, I mean, where we've grown up and, you know, that, like you said, the air, the soil, the neighborhood, all of that is always going to be a part of who we are. As much as we try to subdue it or, you know, kind of layer these other sort of cultures and experiences on top of it, it's still there. And it will manifest itself in some way, shape, or form, sometime, you know, in our lifetime. And to hear you kind of say the same thing, I really appreciate it, because a lot of times we struggle. Okay, you know, I'm from India, but I haven't lived there for a long, long time. Am I still Indian, or am I American, or am I a mix of both? And is that okay? And I've come to realize that that's totally okay. It's okay to identify myself as Indian, or in your case, identify yourself as, you know, from Azerbaijan. Baku is, you know, your experiences have been still such a big part of you. So it's heartening to hear that it's all right. It's all right to let those kind of feelings manifest itself in some way, in some creative way, or even just thoughts and feelings. You're not kind of doing any disservice to, you know, your adopted country or your home country if you kind of pick it up at some point, right?
No, I think that immigration makes us, in a way, just bigger human beings. And, you know, my experience of going to my home country, to my hometown after 30 years, after writing a book that is becoming their contemporary classic. And I even, you know, I met with the Minister of Culture, I think that it wasn't just going to this city, because city changed tremendously. It's probably one of the most beautiful cities in the world now I've ever been. And I even said that going there and coming back, it was like I went to a fairy tale and returned from the fairy tale. But I met with the Minister of Culture and we discussed all these elements. And he said to me that when I mentioned something that you remember that. And he said, Ella, you are Batinka, which means, you know, you are ours. No matter how long you haven't been here, no matter what languages you speak, you came here. And I responded, I said, you know, I had Baku in my memory for 30 years. But now as I am here, I feel that I have always had Baku in my heart as well.
Yeah. Do you, you've, like you said, you've kind of gone, you went back after 30 years. Physically, it's changed quite a bit. What about more subconsciously? Did you find it easy for you to kind of mingle and integrate back into, you know, that culture and the place and the people? Or was it kind of a little difficult?
Incredibly easy. Incredibly easy. First of all, it is a unique place. And the reason I went there, I was a part of a humanitarian forum. It's a very interesting process that Azerbaijan initiated. It is a unique place in respect that there is no tension whatsoever, ethnic tension. Does not exist, unfortunately, only between Azerbaijanis and Armenians. It's still war that's going on.
Right.
But outside of this very unfortunate conflict, being Jewish in Azerbaijan is incredible pride. Being Russian, being anyone else, American, German, everything, it's a unique place in the world where it's incredibly respected that you are different. I have to say that I even when I grew up in the Soviet Azerbaijan, I took pride in the fact that there were over 100 different ethnicities living in the city. And I think that one trend that continued, and with whatever problems any country can have, this country, uniqueness of this country, is that wonderful melting pot of cultures and mutual respect and admiration, which made my coming back, that's why I'm joking, I'm saying that for me, it was like a homecoming queen visit. the way I was hosted and way, but I walked the streets. I went to the gorgeous, by the way, Center of Books. And I spoke with the security guard who sat there, stood there, who is 28 years old, and he poured me right away his desire to do this and his inability to do that. And his, you know, it's the same thing. It's a humanity. It's that very strong sense of humanity that, yes, I discovered for myself in America. In a less, maybe version, I even discovered it here in London. But that wonderful sense of country that still speaks my language, despite this Zaha Hadid's amazing architecture and the most exclusive and delicious restaurants that every door is another one. Still, this place is native to me.
Yeah,
yes, it's very fun. Easy.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's that feeling of going home, that, you know, that connection that one of my other guests had mentioned this word. She said energy matches, where, you know, you kind of feel that attraction to a place and you can't quite put your finger on it. Sometimes it's, you know, from a past life, or sometimes it's just, you know, our lives that, you know, like you going back, there's always that feeling like you've never left, whatever the circumstances of you leaving, you know, when you go back, that feeling of, you know, you've never left. So,
you know, I always have a good comparison that in music, I always say that music is not in the in the notes, but in what is between them. And I think that, and the same thing in the theater, when there is a phrase and then there is a pause. And the way we connect with our audience is through those pauses. Because it's that, what we're talking about, that genetic connection, that inherited, whatever inert connection that we have with our people, with our places of childhood. We do develop to some extent, we begin to understand, let's say, anecdotes in our adopted countries.
Right.
We begin to use references to situations and to names and to some events, but still those pauses are the ones during which we have that very, as your other guest said, energy match happens in those very moments. This is, I guess, that divine part of our humanity.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. Now, you know, you've sort of moved around quite a bit, and now you've had an opportunity to kind of go back home and kind of, you know, get that experience too. Are you ever homesick? Like, do you ever kind of find yourself thinking about, you know, your childhood, or just that feeling of homesickness, I guess, for lack of a better word?
You know, I have to say to you, probably I feel you sick. as for homesick, this is one thing about moving that much. And I am not the one who adjusts to new places and faces quickly enough. But nevertheless, you know, I really don't know anymore what I miss, because I've got home in California. I emotionally consider Chicago one and only home I've had after I left Soviet Union. We lived there for 10 years. I have my parents buried there, and I have my sister living there, and I have my dearest friends living in Chicago. Now I am here in London, developed a good circle of friends here, interesting places I love, a particular art gallery or particular coffee shop, something. But I think that I cannot say that I am homesick. I went to Baku. We're talking now about adapting my book into film. I know that I'll be going back now there. But to say that I am homesick, probably not. I think that, and I don't know, I cannot talk for others, but I think for us artists, home is not a geographical, physical place. I think it is that sacred place inside ourselves to which we hold on, find escape, find source of inspiration, source of new information, source of comfort. So I won't speak for other artists, I'll speak for myself. I think that's probably where I'm homesick. When I am not creative, I really, really, really try to reconnect with that place, which is inside.
No, that's beautifully said. I know, I mean, there are, you know, there are definitely two schools of thought of, you know, wherever I am and wherever I have my life now is home. So I try to make the most of it. And then there's the other school of thought that, you know, yes, there is, you know, there's some places that feel more at, where I feel more at home, or I feel more at ease than others. But you've kind of expressed it so beautifully from a creative standpoint, from an artistic standpoint, that the place where you create, whether it's physical or internal, is home. So thank.
Yeah, it might also have to do also with age, perhaps. Because, you know, when I was younger, I always used to say, I need to be in the center of something. Like when I was in Moscow, I had to live in the center of the city. It could be tiny little apartment, but I had to see the stars of the Kremlin, okay? Then I lived in Chicago. I lived in Lincoln Park. I loved the energy. We lived in California. It was Laguna Beaches, a small town between Los Angeles and San Diego. And I struggled at first until we moved to a place that was right on the water. So all I had to do was walk 21 steps to the water. So to me, I convinced myself that this incredible, this Pacific Ocean is going to be that source of energy for me that before Moscow or Chicago provided. Now we're in London, in the center of the city. But I have to tell you, I was in Dublin, and we went to a tiny, tiny town with, I don't know, maybe 300 people. And I remember going and saying, I could totally live here now with my computer, with a few of my favorite books, with my music. I would be as happy as I am in the center of London, maybe even less distracted.
Right, right. Incredible. This has been such a fascinating conversation, Ella. Thank you so much. Just maybe a couple of questions to sort of wrap it up. So what lies ahead for you? Are you like living your dream, or are you, you know, there's some other interesting stuff that you perhaps can share with us that's coming up next?
I'm working on my next novel. I am working on some music. I just did a song for a TV show. And what I really am excited about doing a film based on my book. And I'm very happy with the process. Kind of was set in motion during my visit to Baku. Also, you know, I'm thinking of traveling. I'm going to premiere of my girlfriend in Budapest of her symphony. I'm going to Malta. I guess just continuing. Can I say that I'm living my dream? I don't know. I don't know. It almost now sounds very beautifully juvenile, you know? I think that I just like to keep busy. I like when my mind is busy with ideas. I feel, I almost feel that I slide into depression when I just kind of feel stuck. But I think it's this creative process that I have no idea where it's going to take me tomorrow.
Yes, no, I've spoken like a true creative. We constantly want to express that creativity. We want to keep doing things. We want to explore. We want to ideate. When we have none of that, we feel stuck. And we feel like you said, a little depressed because you're not doing something. You're not expressing that creativity, all that pent up energy. So I can completely relate to that. But thank you so much, Ella. I wish you the very, very best. I'm so excited to follow your journey. I want to read the book. I want to watch the film. I want to listen to the music. So thank you so much. I really appreciate it coming on.
Wonderful to speak to you. I love your energy and I love what you're doing.
Thank you. Thank you for joining us on this episode of Culturally Ours. Check out the show notes at culturallyours.com. If you've enjoyed the show, please be sure to hit subscribe, leave us a review, and share it with your family and friends.